Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the OrthoTalk podcast, episode number 19. This week, we are joined by Dr. Sean Thompson. Dr. Thompson is a private orthopedic surgeon in the New York City area. He did his orthopedic surgery residency at SUNY Stony Brook and did an arthroplasty fellowship at NYU after that. He started his career in academics, but moved to a solo private practice years later in the New York City area. And that is not something a lot of people do nowadays. It's pretty tough out there to be a solo practitioner, but he's been pretty successful at it. And we talk about how he's been able to maintain that practice and his transition from academics to practice and how that's affected his family life. We talk about his work-life balance and also talk about his experiences in the pandemic. And he actually firsthand dealt with COVID and talk about how he was able to manage that and his experience with that. So hope you guys enjoy the show. Without further ado, Dr. Sean Thompson.
Hey, can we time out? All right. All good dudes, stop what you're doing. This is Time Out. This is the OrthoTalk podcast. Today, we are doing a real conversation with an illustrious guest. Surgeons today are Asif Khalid and Jay Chen. Antibiotics, ANSEF, of course. What do we even ask? Fire risk, high due to lit conversations and explosive topics. Any questions or concerns? Nope. All right, we can go. Incision.
Welcome back, everybody, to the OrthoTalk podcast, episode number 19. I'm doing this again because I got the name wrong on the last one, so my bad. We have a very special guest with us, Dr. Sean Thompson. Dr. Thompson, thank you for joining us today. Sorry for getting your name wrong. How are you doing?
All good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I will own up to my mistake there. So thanks for coming on, Dr. Thompson. Can you, let's just start with a little bit about your background. Where do you come from? How'd you get into medicine? How'd you get into orthopedics? Basically, how did you get to where you are today?
Right. So my family is originally from Jamaica. I grew up in New York, Queens, and then Long Island until let's say elementary school. We moved out to the West Coast, went to high school out there, college at UCLA, and then made myself kind of move back to the East Coast by way of St. Louis, which was a kind of a culture shock going from LA to St.
Yeah,
Louis.
Yeah, I bet.
You know,
you're probably happy you came back too, huh?
Yeah, eventually, you know. So but it was a great experience. I mean, actually, when I was in St. Louis, the Rams followed us because, you know, the Rams were in L.A.
Right. Oh, wait, so they followed you from – so this is the original move from L.A. to St. Louis the first time?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Yes. So when I was in med school, the Rams actually, you know, won the Super Bowl, so that was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. That was, late 1990s with Marshall Faulk and the greatest show on turf.
Right.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. I remember that Super Bowl. It was against the Titans because I remember. I think that was the first year they had moved from Houston too. So I was watching that one. And that was the one where they came up 1 yard short of winning.
Yeah. Remember that?
Yeah. So cool. So how'd you get into orthopedics? What drove that passion and how'd you get there?
As I was mentioning to you guys earlier, I just got back from coaching my son's fourth grade peewee football. So they're just in pads now. I used to play football, but I mean, and a lot of other sports when I was younger. And so obviously, like most of us are going to ortho, have some type of affinity towards athletics and sports injuries and stuff. Actually, when I was at UCLA, I was a physical therapy aide. And
nice.
Got to work with a couple guys at UCLA and do, you know, rehab. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, went on from there.
Yeah, cool. So you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but did the thought ever cross your mind of not letting your son play football?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
It didn't cross my mind. It was actually beaten in my mind by my wife.
Yeah.
You know, and so – The point of football, I think, as a male maturing, I mean, he's nine, but I think that the thing that I took away from high school football was like teamwork, camaraderie.
Yeah.
So it's definitely one of the hardest physical sports to play. you know, but it teaches you, it kind of helped me, you know, stay grounded. And I think he's realizing that too, you know.
Yeah, I think we both grew up playing basketball, and I think you're right. The team sport aspect is huge, and
of course,
you really notice a difference in the people who have kind of been through and played athletics, and just, you know, been in a team environment. Really, it's just it's almost like those are the kind of people you want to be around and work around, and it really helps. I wasn't allowed to play football, that's why I asked. I had the frame for it, I had the body for it.
Yeah,
yeah.
My mom.
I wanted to go out for receiver, and I wasn't allowed to play also because I'm pretty tall. I would have been. I was 6'2" in high school, and I was super fast. You can ask Mo. I'm actually not making that up. But, but I was slight, so my parents didn't want me getting beat up. I just played basketball.
Okay, well, basketball. Yeah. I mean, he's also played basketball. He's playing basketball too, but I mean, did you guys have any personal like injuries around the family or friends? Was that the reason why, or that it was just
My mom was just she was just cautious.
My parents were just overprotective in a way, right. And you know, we have I have a 7-year-old girl and a 4-year-old boy, and it's funny with all this concussion stuff coming out, and my wife's talking about not letting my son play football. And as we know from orthopedics, actually gymnastics has a lot of injuries as well. Right. And she wants my daughter to do gymnastics. So I'm like, well, if he's not playing football, if she's not doing gymnastics, right. And they can both just stay home and do nothing. But I like to encourage them all to do sports.
I
actually saw a study recently saying that a lot of the head injuries and stuff at the youth level have gone down, and it's not exactly due to participation drop either. It's just change in rules, and
of course,
a lot of the technique changes. It's really helped a lot. So I think,
You're right. The awareness is definitely increased with, you know, tackling and keeping your head up and not tackling with the head, and, you know, so it was crazy, actually. So this was the first day back, and one of the coaches, I didn't coach last year. He was in third grade, and that's the first year, you know, they play with pads. Mm-hmm. And so his kid had a supercondylar on the field.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, everyone was in panic, and the coaches were, like, turning away, like, throw up. And,
yeah.
You know, so I kind of he wanted to hug me. He was like, I'm so happy that you were there or whatever. But, yeah, he ended up getting pinned that night. We sent him over
to him. Wow.
Yeah. I'll go to the hospital. But
Are you the de facto?
Believe it or not, he's back.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Wow. It's kids, man. Kids growth plays.
Yeah.
Can do anything to them.
Yep.
So are you the team doctor for every sport your kids are going to be on?
Pretty much, yeah. Team doctor for the kids and their parents who have, like,
nice.
Hysterics and
yeah. Yeah, it's funny you say that you're you know, quick to jump on there, because I remember when we were in residency, and I've seen this a couple times. It's kind of like the doctor on a plane phenomenon, where they ask for a doctor and nobody wants to get up. We were playing we were doing an intramural softball game, and the pitcher I was on the other team got hit with the ball and kind of crouched down, and everyone's asking, is there a doctor? We were a team full of orthopedic surgeons, and not one person gets out to go help
him. Yeah, it's weird. And then they probably, you know, because you guys are probably, like, young guys there, and they're probably believing that you're like, no, we're expecting, like, an older 60-year-old.
Right.
I remember I was on a plane, and, yeah, this lady passed out in the back. And, you know, I'm always low-key. I was there with, like, a sweatshirt on and, you know, sweatpants. And so I'm the one that ends up having to walk back. Like, okay, now, where's the real doctor? All right. Whatever. Suffering. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that happened to me last year. I think someone was having some chest pain or something. He asked for a doctor, and I sent my girlfriend, who's a nurse practitioner, over there instead of me. Because I'm like, I asked her, like, what do you want me to do? Go fix his ankle? Like, what am I going to do with chest pain? You were an ER nurse for, you know, however many years. You're way more trained to do this. But, apparently, they're, like, asking for licenses now. So, like, not anyone can just walk back there and start helping. Like, they actually want to see.
Who's walking around with their...
That's one of my biggest nightmares, is being on a plane and someone's having a true medical emergency. and I need to dose their insulin or something crazy. And I don't know. I don't even think I have that app on my phone. I don't have the app on my phone to dose meds anymore either. So it's
just... ask for the free Wi-Fi and shoot a phone call. So you're in New York, and we were talking about this a little bit before. You are really, honestly, one of the few people I've met that are in solo practice, in, especially in a major metropolitan city. How did you end up doing that?
So I started out at, you know, I finished fellowship at joint disease at NYU. I stayed on faculty there for a couple of years until like 2013 or so. And I went over to another health system. I kind of learned the ropes, you know, being an academic physician, and, you know, I had to teach myself kind of the business aspect of being in private practice, but I still kept the affiliations with the hospitals.
Okay.
So, you know, I'd still take call, and, you know, I was able to kind of maintain the patient base that I had prior to going into private practice. And, you know, word of mouth definitely helped. I mean, things like ZocDoc and, you know, those other, you know, web advertising.
Like health grades and vitals. And
Definitely your Google standing, especially with your reviews, makes a big difference. I learned that even recently within the last couple of years, because even though, you know, you guys, I'm sure, noticed that, you know, the happy patients, and most of them, fortunately, were happy. They don't always leave the reviews negative, and, you know, may have, and it's not, and, you know, for me, most of my reviews were not about me. Like, the reviews would say, oh, the doctor's great, but staff. We have all the staff, or, you know, they didn't get my paperwork back in time. Or you know, I've networking with other physicians, like, you know, one of my buddies who's a spine surgeon in the area, you know, we'll refer back and forth, and then, you know, you kind of build a, you know, referral pattern that way. Unfortunately, it's worked so far.
Yeah. So
what was the reason, the reason for leaving academics? Because, you know, we're just coming out of training, and both of us want to do academics. We're both still kind of wide-eyed, and we want to teach and all those things. You know, why did you transition out of that, having done both?
Right. And that, you know, I did enjoy, I definitely think that an academic training setting is an important way to get founded, or a good foundation, you know, as a practicing physician, you know, sitting for your boards or whatever, and staying adept with the current literature. I left after a couple years. I mean, not without getting into much of it, there was, you know, some politics that had to do with it. And, you know, I saw other friends who were in private practice, and they definitely were happier, you know, I mean, as far as the work schedule and the commitments to call and all of those things. So I felt like I was ready to do, you know, I was definitely able to go out on my own. And, you know, I was at a level one trauma center, as well as, you know, private Manhattan office setting. And, you know, when I went out on my own, I was, you know, put it like this, the first day I was on call, I had, without an exaggeration, 22 to 26 open fractures for that weekend. So, yeah, when I moved to, you know, my private practice hospital, where, you know, we mainly do hip nailings and, you know, I was pleasantly surprised.
So you find the lifestyle to be a lot easier in the private world.
Absolutely. You know, and especially, you know, I have three kids. I mentioned I have a wife who's a physician. When we're both on call or away, fortunately we have, you know, a nanny or someone to help out, but I like to, you know, stay involved with them at a young age, and allow me to do that, whether it's, you know, family vacation or, you know, take them snowboarding or whatever.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, cool. So, you know, you mentioned earlier a lot of these Google reviews, and I think especially for in the private world, that's the kind of stuff that could really, you know, sink you if you have a lot of those bad reviews, because basically people are looking to see, why should I come to you, right? I mean, if it's not word of mouth and it's, you know, word of mouth through the internet, how much effort do you, basically, how do you handle that? Like, how do you try to increase those reviews, the number of 5-star reviews? How do you kind of put the effort into that?
Right. Well, there, you know, for example, I mentioned ZocDoc. And
yeah.
ZocDoc, for people that are not familiar, you know, you're able to find a position by zip code. You can look up his or her credentials and look at their availability and book an appointment. And my reviews on that website were great, you know, usually like 5, mm-hmm. greater than 4.5 or whatever it is. And I never really encouraged the feedback, but I guess to be a member or to sign up, you had to leave, you know, either recommendation or not recommend or what have you.
Gotcha.
Now that I don't use that service that much, we have a service that texts the patient to, you know, evaluate their review, and they can, mm-hmm. text, you know, whatever it is, and choose where it goes, whether it's Yelp or Google or whatever. And, you know, I'll encourage it, or my office staff will encourage them to leave one. And, you know, even so, even after all that, maybe 20% leave a review. You know?
Yeah.
Everyone.
You just had to hope it's the right ones.
Yeah, exactly.
What about other forms of marketing? Like, how else do you get your name out? Because especially in New York and New Jersey, right, that's a huge area. It's a lot of orthopedic. But how do you differentiate yourself with other marketing?
It's challenging. Fortunately, it doesn't seem like it could be possible. Word of mouth definitely makes a difference. Uh-huh. Like, I'll have a patient and they'll come, you know, their relative will come back. For example, today, I saw a post-op hip replacement that I did in 2011, you know, when I first started. And she came in because she, you know, was in a fender bender, and, you know, we looked at the x-rays, everything looked fine. And, but she mentioned to me, oh, you know, my daughter is such and such, who's a primary care physician that refers to me in the area. And, so, you know, again, that relationship, you know, 9 years later, she decided, yeah, I'm going to follow up with him, even though maybe, you know, I wasn't close in her area, and I wasn't at the same hospital anymore and what have you, but so that helps.
Yeah. So it sounds like a word of mouth is a really important thing, especially over there.
Did you find it, just for me, the whole thought of running a private practice on my own, I wouldn't even know where to start. Like, to be honest, you know, we get such little business training, medicine and residency. How did you find it daunting at first? How did you attack it? And what kinds of things did you do to get ready for that?
Well, the model I used was, you know, without, you know, sometimes when you go into practice after leaving, say you left academics and you were in the same city, you know, you'd have to make sure you're not violating your non-compete, which, you know, to open up locations in the same areas that I was.
Yeah.
You know, in Queens, which is just one of the boroughs, obviously, of New York, and then one of Manhattan. So, you know, and pretty much my workflow was, for the first couple of years, mirrored what I did in academic practice. But I would spend maybe 30% of that time meeting other practitioners or, you know, physical therapists and other referral sources in those areas to help build, you know. The other thing was, just like you mentioned, with your locums, there were other opportunities that, you know, I would seek out in order to supplement my income. right? Until I couldn't just survive on just, you know, putting up shingle. But, you know, once everything was 100%, I was able to give up some of those positions and focus on my own practice.
So do you currently operate out of a surgery center, or is it like a hybrid? Do you still go back to the trauma hospital every now and then, or?
So for the inpatient cases, like the, you know, the joints and revisions, I'll do obviously in the hospitals. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how it is in Houston, but in the last 2 months, pretty much all of my patients were, I don't want to say pushed out, but they
had to. It's the same here. Yeah. I know what you mean.
And, you know, it's a little bit scary to think about that, because you know, some of those patients,
but
knock on wood, fortunately, there haven't been any complications, but so that's a big shift. So now a lot of the surgical centers over here are looking to take on, you know, those cases. Mm-hmm. And definitely those in practice that have ownership in centers can benefit. Right. You know, I'm sure, you know, you guys are doing a lot of outpatient stuff.
That change really happened, at least for me. I saw really the last year was this push to get everyone outpatient. Yeah. I know that I think CMS made the change maybe 2 years ago. Right. But I didn't really see it until last year when we're really starting to get a lot of these outpatient joints going. Right. I mean, you've obviously done this a lot longer than me. What do you think about that?
I think 24 hours is difficult for any patient, especially a patient that's over, you know, 60 and comorbidities, obese, you know, I think it's aggressive, to be honest. You have a lot of pushback from the hospital. I will say, I take that back. There was one patient that, you know, because she was so, she had chronic disease and she really wasn't walking and really was very debilitated before surgery. Once she did have the surgery, she still had a difficult time, obviously.
Yeah.
No. She did have to go to a rehab. There's no way she could have.
Yeah.
But I guess that's the trend. I mean, the problem is, if you got, you know, for those of us that do joint replacement, it is a taxing, 90 days to have to follow patients.
Yep.
You know, and the reimbursement is terrible. And I do think that we need to do better for advocating for, you know, higher reimbursements for those populations.
Yeah. No, because I know. Oh, go ahead, Jay.
Just how have you handled that whole reimbursement aspect with insurance companies? Basically, you're doing that on your own, right? Or are you in a part of a larger group that's negotiating with them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, usually the rates are, because we're, you know, I'm affiliated with one of the health systems here. You know, again, the rates aren't great. Some plans I'm out of network with, and some plans I don't take, you know, and other plans I'm in with. But for me, I used to outsource my billing. Now I have my billing in-house, so I have people that can help advise on, you know, what the best setup is.
Mm-hmm.
My area.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, I saw, you know, with the whole change to the E&M coding coming next year, I saw that, I think part of that was cutting the reimbursement for total joints even more, I think by a significant amount. And, you know, now it's becoming a big push. And we talk about advocacy, and, you know, we have AOS, I think it's one of the biggest medical advocacy groups, but I don't really see them ever actually getting this stuff done, you know? So I don't know how much power we actually have to do that. I feel like we're just at the whim of the people above us, and sometimes it's just desperate. Like,
yeah.
It's hopeless.
Right.
It's a scary thought.
I mean, how can, you know, we know what we make, you know, it's ridiculous. You know,
yeah, and there's lots of literature showing that too, and, you know, how much the surgeon reimbursement is going down, and the costs and the charges by the hospital are staying the same, and, you know, it's all about where that money is going, and, you know, it's not going to the surgeon, and the cases aren't getting that much more complex. we're being asked to do more too. So I don't know. It's kind of scary, especially coming out of fellowship.
Right. And,
you know, it's like, why did I do this again?
I guess, you know, the bottom line is, I don't, you know, obviously there are more and more joints that are indicated, and that number is going to continue to increase. I guess those that are in, you know, a hospital setting or, you know, RVU setting, it doesn't really matter to them. Right. I don't know. You know, I mean, that's what I'm guessing. But obviously, if the reimbursements are lower, the RVUs are going to be lower as well.
Right.
But I don't see how it's going to be sustainable.
Yeah, and I don't think it's definitely going to go up again. I don't think we're ever going to get, you know, back to a higher reimbursement rate. It's just trying to maintain what they're giving us now.
Right.
So
like they change something, and then us as physicians, we adapt and we change the way we code and bill and write our notes. And then as soon as they see that we're catching on, they change it again. And they're like, well, we'll try to adjust this time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of a game in a way almost.
Right.
Yeah, I think unfortunately joints is kind of the playground for it because it's a common procedure. But yeah, you know, we're talking about that paradigm shift, and it brings flashbacks to when I started residency and all the joints were staying 3-4 days in the hospital, and it's like a short hotel stay. Now it's like now you know, in fellowship, I mean, obviously, you know, I did a sports fellowship. I wasn't getting a lot of the complex joint patients, but you know, that at least they were trying to force us to push them all out. PT is like, you know, aggressively moving them around right after surgery, getting them moving. And, you know, I guess I guess the studies will show whether it's beneficial or not. I don't think it's going to matter to the reimbursement, though. I think money's going to be the bottom line in this.
And also, we talk about when we read studies, we want to look at who conflicts of interest and the authors and who wrote them. But there's also a conflict of interest now, I think, to publish studies that show that outpatient surgery is cost effective and safe. If you write a study showing it's safe for this procedure, it's almost guaranteed to be published in some journal.
Right.
Like people want to read that stuff. People want that to be published. So if I write something showing that it's not safe, I don't think it's going to be as popular, you know, JBJS, as if I wrote a paper saying that it is safe and cost effective. So I wonder if there's a little bit of a bias there as well in the literature.
Yeah. So let me ask you a little bit more about your practice. So do you utilize mid-levels in your practice?
Yeah, I have a few PAs that work for me in the practice.
Mm-hmm. And do you, because I've seen them use a lot of different ways. How do you usually use yours? Is there one dedicated to surgery? Is there one dedicated to clinic? Do they switch? Or like how do you kind of optimize your mid-levels?
So there are a few PAs that I use, especially in the outpatient setting. The hospital that I use in Queens is all mainly PAs. We have a few residents, but you know, I will say that the difference, for example, at Lenox Hill, for example, we have both PA and resident coverage. But as you know, when with the different skill levels of residents, you know, when they start up to when they're a fellow, will affect, you know, your speed, how much you can do in a day and what have you, even if you have two rooms. With the PAs, they pretty much know everything that I do. The patient's really, you know, set up. Sometimes two or three PAs as opposed to one resident.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
So yeah.
It's a nice change.
Right.
In the office setting, I'll have PAs helping with the post-ops and the injections and what have you, and some of the follow-ups. The difficult thing, I guess, is, you know, training a new PA. It's like having a resident, and you know, in PA school or as nurse practitioners, they don't really get that exposure to ortho. So, for example, the one that I hired this year, I gave her my old letters with the notes in it.
Yeah.
You know, the what was that? Is it first aid? Did ortho have like?
Yep.
Yeah. You know, so she's like taking notes and
nice
for without rounds, but you know, it's fun. You know, but I think, you know, I think it's necessary. You know, mid levels are definitely important when for those of us in private practice.
Yeah, especially to keeping your efficiency going, because right. that's really the name of the game, right? Is being efficient with your time. So. Yeah.
Even with the outpatient surgical cases, you know, if you can have more than one anesthesia, you can have more than one room that they can do the blocks, and you can get in and out within a few hours.
How's that been with COVID, or when it was in this? Because you were pretty much in the heart of it, right?
Yeah. So I was in Queens. I mean, actually, I was exposed.
Oh, were you?
Yeah. My symptoms were more GI, but I definitely had the, you know, shortness of breath and the
taste. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And yeah, I was still on call, so it was a good.
Oh, wow.
It was a difficult because I remember the day actually that I think I was exposed. Our OR is on the 7th floor, and the ICU is right next to the OR. And at that time, they had. This was like the beginning of March. They had 5 people, I think, vents. And in the ER, they had maybe 7 or so pending cases that were, you know. And, you know, it presented Sunday, like the weekend after my on-call case on Thursday. You know, I had a temp of like 102.
Oh, and, shoot.
Yeah, but it lasted like a day, maybe 2 days, night sweats. I went and got tested right away the following day. And then I distanced myself from, you know, the family here. Fortunately, they didn't test positive and they
wow.
didn't.
Yeah. That was crazy. How did your practice deal with it? Do you take a bit of a hit? And
yeah, you know, at that time, we were pretty much, we closed down around the week of the 18th or 20th, something like that. And I was able to see patients, you know, using Zoom or whatever we're doing now, you know. It was frightening because you don't really know what to expect and you hear about
people. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, definitely all the symptoms, the loss of the taste and smell for a little bit and, yeah, you know.
That's crazy. How long did it take for your taste and smell to recover? I heard it took someone I know, it took him 6 weeks.
Yeah. No, that may be a week. But I will say, like, you know, I try to stay fit somewhat when I can, and I'll run and, you know, get in the weight room. But every once in a while, for me, I can still kind of feel like air hunger, you know, where you kind of, you just need to take a deep breath.
Yeah.
And, so I think it's going to be interesting to see in long-term what the outcomes will be, you know, cause I mean, my chest x-ray and everything is normal. I have an O2 sat machine here in the house.
Yeah. I read a news article saying, I don't know my New York geography very well, but I guess there's some area in New York City that is 50% positive on antibody tests or something in a large scale study, basically meaning that like half of this population was exposed at some point.
Right.
That's crazy to me.
Yeah.
That's like herd immunity almost.
I know. We'll see. How are you guys doing in Texas with the,
it's calmed down a good bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't in Houston for the major hit that happened like a few weeks ago, last month. But I was in New Orleans New York's had a spike and then New Orleans just kind of followed right after. Right. And then we shut down for probably about 4 to 6 weeks.
Right. Like,
no elective cases or anything. So we were doing a couple of urgent cases every now and then.
Yeah.
But it recovered pretty quick, actually. Like once they kind of got the hospitals prepared, Because you know, unfortunately, New York was kind of like the canary in the coal mine for everyone, because we saw all the horror stories coming out of the hospitals there, and you know, it scared the crap out of a lot of people here. So you know, we shut down pretty proactively and just kind of diverted a lot of the stuff to the ICUs. And I know some of my attendings, they were doing ICU shifts just to spell the ICU doctors. And you know, you have like orthopedic guys who've been out in practice for 5-10 years. Yeah. They're carrying around cheat sheets on ventilators. And I asked them like what exactly they were doing when we started running back. I'm like, so how was it? What'd you guys do? And they said basically their job was sometimes they would have to round with the residents and fellows in the critical care unit, and they would basically just sign off on whatever they were doing. Sometimes they would kind of plan them in front of all the telemonitor screens, and they would basically just watch for alarms on whatever rooms, and then they would call the ICU doctor and say, hey, this guy needs you to go see him. So it's kind of interesting how they diverted our resources, but yeah. You know, we got through it. There was definitely a big scare there for a second, and I think now I think a lot of the places are kind of overcoming that. They're starting to get back to some sort of normal. I know New York's starting to open up a little bit now, right? I think gyms.
Yeah, I think the only thing is that there's no indoor dining. Like in Jersey, indoor dining is open to 25%, but in New York, they haven't done that in the city. And I think a lot of these businesses they won't be able to last, unfortunately.
Yeah, they're not going to survive. It's going to be a killer.
I heard they want to push back until next spring.
So, really?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's probably because. How did you guys come to the decision to let your kid play organized football? I wonder, because you know there's organized sports opening here for the kids also, and my wife and I are just like, should we let him play or should we keep him at home? Like, do you have to think hard about that, or was it kind of a obvious choice?
Last week, my 7-year-old and 9-year-old started a hybrid school model, so they're in class 4 days, 4 hours a day. Mm-hmm. The 7-year-old only has like maybe 12 people in her class in second grade. So they go every day for, you know, cause they can spread out 4 hours, come home at 12, and then they do virtual stuff, you know, with their teachers. And then the fourth grader, he'll go every other day for 4 hours. So, you know, they're using masks, as best that they can, you know.
There's a bunch of kids.
Yeah. You know, even when they lined up, and this goes back to the, you know, I could change my office hours. I have my PA start seeing. Yeah. So I made sure I went with their mom the first day of school to see how things were set up. And, they lined up 6 feet apart and, you know, they're going in like, it's kind of, you know. Crazy.
Nice. Yeah.
So yeah, with football, you know, the five coaches, we spread out, we wear masks. The kids, you know, we were just doing walkthroughs, so there wasn't much contact. Mm-hmm. But I think it's inevitable, you know, there's going to be contact.
Yeah, especially in football.
Right.
You can't really hide it.
Yeah. But you're outside as opposed to indoors in the gym, so.
Yeah.
Exactly. I will say that their temperature checks every practice, before every practice, 15 minutes. There is a waiver that has to be signed for the town, you know, but we'll see.
Yeah. My daughter's in online school right now, and it's pretty horrible. I mean, they're doing the best they can. I'm not going to lie, but like they're, you know, 7 hours a day in front of a screen for a 7-year-old kid. And they have a requirement that an adult is with them at all times for technical issues. Right. Just to navigate the platforms.
Yeah.
So my wife is like there for 7 hours. She's basically repeating second grade. So I'm telling my wife, she's learning all these skills that she, you know, she either forgot or never knew. So she's learning her times tables in addition, and it's, you know, it's pretty funny. I'm glad I don't have to be that parent right now.
Yeah, I tried to help out last school year when they were doing some of that stuff, and I felt really dumb, you know.
Yeah.
some of the stuff they were asking me. I was like, well, go ask your mom.
Yeah. Well, they've changed the way they teach some of it, too. There's, right. like, this different way they teach math now. It's not the way we learned it, so, you know, I just hope I don't get asked those questions. I'll look really dumb if I don't know how to do, like, 20 plus 30 the way they teach it.
So let's talk a little bit about work-life balance, because you mentioned the move to private practice earlier has really helped with that. How do you balance that in your life?
Meaning what I like
time, to, yeah, like time management, like, yeah. What do you like to do for, like, outside and, what keeps
you sane? Say it again.
What keeps you sane?
Yeah. All right. So we'll start with this morning. Before I went in, I got up, well, this morning's not a good idea. I actually was looking at the Barron's and to see how bad my stocks were going to tank today. And you know, usually I'll get on the treadmill and I'll watch CNBC or something, and you know, work. You know, I'll try to work out that. Because you know, without that, I think it's I need that for my sanity. I need to be. To do some type of exercise and, you know, have some type of stress. My commute to Manhattan from where I am in North Jersey is about 40 minutes. So I'll, you know, drive, listen to the news, listen to some music.
Yeah.
And you know, usually my office environment is not stressful. For the most part, I enjoy what I do, and, you know, I like seeing the outcomes of, you know, how patients are improving, you know, after minor injuries or, you know, after surgery or what have you. And even though most of my patients and staff will say that, you know, I'm serious and, you know, I'm like, I don't know. I don't always smile with them and you know, but, you know, I'm serious to a point where,
sorry, I think we might have had
the audio messed up for about 10 seconds.
Let me see here. See, somehow it got muted. Let's see.
I hit unmute. I don't know.
There you go. Yep. We got you. Perfect.
My mood is always positive because of what happens before my day starts and what happens after my day ends. And I realize when, like, older people would tell me, kid, you know, enjoy your kids. They're little, only a little amount of time. And so I look forward to getting home and, even if it's for a few minutes, finding, you know, speaking to them about little stuff or playing around or throwing football or watching them ride the bike, you know what I mean? Or because, you know, once they get a certain age, they don't want to mess with you anymore. on my OR days, you know, I'm fortunate to be able to schedule my outpatient surgeries in the morning so I can go play golf, because I'm like a golfer for about 6 years, so I'm addicted. Other than that, you know, I like cars.
You want to tell us what cars you got?
I have a 720 McLaren.
Oh wow. And your commute's only 40 minutes?
the 8 series BMW, which is pretty nice. I used to have
eight,
pretty nice. But it seems so slow compared to the
to the McLaren. I bet.
Oh man,
oh, that's awesome.
I have a 2009 Toyota Camry.
That's okay. You haven't made a paycheck yet, so
yeah.
I remember, I had a 99 Maxima or 90, yeah.
Yeah.
But I will say that if you talk to any of my co-residents and guys in my residency class, I've always loved cars. So when I started making
those were your big things.
Yeah, I ended up getting a 640 BMW. You remember those, like?
Yeah.
My attendings, you know, not my, the ortho attendings didn't hate me, but the general surgeon.
That's awesome. That is refreshing to hear, because you know a lot of the things you hear about private practice is just it's hustle and you got to go and eat what you kill. But I mean, it sounds like you carved out a real nice life for yourself. And
yeah, fortunately,
it's especially in a big city like New York. Man, it's got to be daunting.
Right. Yeah.
But, yeah.
And then actually, at my club, we got at the country club I belong to. Uh-huh. Lou Bigliani, and Chit Ranawat, and sons are members there. So we got a couple. We got
a nice,
you know, ortho group.
Yeah.
No, that's great. So, so cars, working out, family. It's, I mean, it sounds like you got the whole thing covered there.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And you live in New Jersey, is that right?
Yeah, North Jersey. So. You got Manhattan and then Hudson, George Washington Bridge. You guys are not here, but
I know there's a lot of bridges. There's a bridge in Manhattan or somewhere, right? Oh, Brooklyn. That's what it was. The Brooklyn Bridge.
The Brooklyn Bridge. Queens Bridge, too.
So, yeah, to get to work in Queens, I got to cross two bridges, George Washington and the Throgneck, which is, It's about 12 miles to my Manhattan office and 20 miles to the Queens office.
Is it just a little more suburban feel out there in New Jersey? Yeah. So it's not really like city living or, you know, cramped spaces, stuff like that.
Like, so when I pulled into my garage, you know, and I brought him home from practice, there was a skunk that we could smell. Yesterday there was a huge possum. I mean, he was like literally in the garbage can in the backyard. Deer everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That's suburban life for sure.
Yeah. Suburban, but it's weird to have that so close to the city, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a cool setup. Houston's kind of like that too, where the suburbs are probably like 30, 40 minutes outside of the big city.
Houston is like all suburbs is the thing.
No one lives in the city. That's the problem. Everyone lives in Houston. The suburbs.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, so it's everyone's just kind of scattered outside. But, I mean, you know, I'm assuming New York is just totally different because I keep hearing the horror stories about real estate prices in the city and nobody wants to live there, so they all kind of branch out. But, I mean, you know, it's different when you have a lot more space because – I mean, New York itself is just so consolidated, you know, and Houston is all over the place, sprawled across the map. So it's got to be a little bit different.
Yeah. I mean, I did my residency out in Stony Brook, which is Long Island.
Okay.
That's the other direction away from Jersey. But again, we were more in the suburbs, but we would take the train into the city when we wanted to drive into the city. Which is like a 45-minute train ride or an hour train ride or whatever. But yeah, it's definitely spread out. You definitely have a lot of suburban areas to live and a lot of, you know, I guess attending, if you guys would be here in New York in comparison, live out in the suburbs, Westchester or Jersey or what have you.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. Yeah, so I mean, like we were talking about before, I'm about to move upstate. And I don't think there's a city anywhere near me. I'm on a lake and I'm having trouble finding a gym. Like, it's that, is that bad?
I couldn't tell you. I'd be able
to. Yeah. So, but I don't know. I think for a temporary thing, it should be, you know, it'll be a good change of pace. And we'll see. Especially for me, you know, just starting to get my practice out. I probably wouldn't be too busy anywhere I go. So, you know, maybe a little bit more low key than you know, actually going to a big trauma center or anything. Plus, I did a sports fellowship, so it's like I'm not, you know, going to be doing a lot of trauma anyways.
So are the interviews picking back up for?
Not so much yet, because you know a lot of these hospitals are waiting on their fiscal years to kind of restart so they can do their budgeting, yeah. And then we'll really see how bad they got hit once that happens. So I know a lot of the hiring freezes are still in place, and I think it's just for that. It's just one, I think people are worried about a second wave coming, and they right. want to be prepared for that. And then two, they're still kind of assessing the damage and seeing how much they can make back up. So I know Jay's at UTMB, and I think like a couple of weeks ago they just laid off a lot of people,
really,
you know, which is what they were trying to avoid doing by kind of, you know, holding incentive plans and, you know, furloughing people. But I think they had to lay off like 200 staff. Wow. Just because, you know, they're running out of money. So it's a little weird, because you would expect you know, some of these bigger hospital systems to be sheltered from something like this. Yeah. But you know, once they stopped elective surgery, it's almost like everyone just got hit. It didn't matter where you were, everyone took a hit there.
I'm feeling optimistic for you though, because the only way to make that money back is to get more elective surgery.
Yeah, right. I mean, you would think if you want to make the budget back up, you should hire someone to do some surgeries and make
that money.
But I mean, you know, maybe I'll have an advantage there. We'll see.
You know, I don't know how it is over there, but the difficulty is when we're booking elective surgeries out here and even inpatient surgeries, is getting them COVID tested, right? And so initially it had to be 72 hours, which was damn near impossible. You could, you know, test it and then get the results and get it back to that.
Yeah.
On time. So now the 5 days, I don't know how you guys are you know, for pre-surgical testing. And then on top of that, I'd say now maybe 10 or 15% of my patients are still hesitant because of COVID, but yeah, most of them are, you know, kind of over it. And
I think that's the general population right now. It's just kind of over it, you know? And, you know, now you have the election coming up, and that's kind of diverting a lot of attention away from COVID itself. So I think everyone's just kind of forgetting about it. And that's probably not a good thing. You know, we'll see how it ends up. But yeah, for us, and before I left fellowship, they kind of had a good system going where, but you know, it was the biggest hospital system in Louisiana, so they could afford to do stat COVID tests on their surgical patients. So, you know, they would come in the day before, get their test in the morning, and then, you know, they would run a stat and get the results back, you know, before their surgery the next day. But I'm not sure how, you know, people outside of a hospital system were doing that, because you're right. The turnaround time on those tests can be so variable.
Yeah.
If you can even get the test, like a lot of the places couldn't even get, you know, get the testing to do it.
Right. I think the problem here was like the reagent was, I guess there were low amounts nationwide. And so, you know, even though you'd get tested here, you'd have to send it out. And that was also another couple day delay. So,
yeah. Hopefully some of these newer tests can help with that too. I know they have like a saliva test, I think, that just got passed thanks to the NBA. Okay. We'll see how that supposed to be like a pretty rapid test.
Yeah.
And then they're talking about a vaccine too coming out in the next couple of months, right? Before we'll see. What's that?
Are you guys getting that if it comes out?
I think we don't have a choice. We're all healthcare providers are going to have to get it, right?
I think the hospital might force it on us. I never really the ethics of that with flu vaccines and with this. I think some people can opt out of the flu vaccine. I don't know if they're going to let them opt out of a COVID vaccine.
Well, there's all this talk about, we don't know how long the immunity lasts for, but I think even if we don't know, what's going to happen is everyone's going to get the vaccine and just forget about it and pretend like it lasts forever. Right. Like, people want to get back to normal life, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, I always wonder, you know, how you got tested. I have antibodies, but it's probably going to be, you know, I don't know how long those antibodies will last, but you know, with that, your body should be able to mount an immune response. They don't necessarily have to be, you know, within your bloodstream.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Thompson, one last question for you before we let you go. We ask everyone this question. What's your favorite bone?
My favorite bone. I'd have to say the femur.
So the reason that's like funny.
Four in a row now.
We've had four in a row.
We
and they've all been joint surgeons.
Huh?
Nobody said femur for like the first few months, and all of a sudden, like four in a row, or four out of five say femur, because one person said the sacrum. But yeah.
That sounds like a fetish.
Right.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. All of our joint surgeons have said the femur, and it makes sense. And I mean, the
most important joints.
Yeah. We need to invite a foot surgeon next time so we can say foot bone. I'm tired of the femur.
All right. Well, Dr. Thompson, it's been fun. Thank you for coming on. Thanks for sharing your experience. And it's been great. So hope to do it again. Thanks.
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Thompson.
All right. Good luck. Good luck with your careers, too.
Yeah, thank you.
And that'll do it for us. Thank you to Dr. Thompson for giving us about an hour of his time. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. It was very interesting getting his perspective on his practice and his life and how he's been able to maintain that. If you do like the show, leave us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening to this episode on. A friendly reminder that all of our episodes can be found on our website, www.orthotalkpod.com. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us, theorthopodcast@gmail.com, or shoot us a message. Follow us on Twitter at OrthotalkPod. We're also on YouTube if you want to see the video of any of the episodes that we do. You can see all of our smiling, friendly faces. And like I said, if you enjoy the show, leave us 5 stars. It really does help us out. And hope you guys are enjoying what we're doing. We'll see you next week. Thank you for the opportunity.